and welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Andrew Heaton, and you have the largest, most stylish belt buckles of anyone I know. My favorite is the hubcap with the dragon on it. Today's episode is going to be the first half of a two-parter. In a moment, I'm going to speak with Jerry Taylor about climate change and a carbon tax. And tomorrow, I will talk to Stuber Gear, who I hesitate to label, but I think is more on the skeptical side of climate change and policy. He'll come on and give his side of the argument. And I'll note, unfortunately, we had a little bit of reception issues with Jerry, so you can hear it, but occasionally it crackles. I'm sorry about that. We'll work on that in the future. Either way, we're going to have to pay the bills. So let's go ahead and get today's sponsor. This week's sponsor actually reached out to me directly, which was very flattering. I have mentioned a couple of times on this podcast that I enjoy a good dram of whiskey now and then. And word got over to some distillers in Hoyk, Scotland. One thing led to another. And I'm thrilled to announce Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by carbonated whiskey from Glenkevin Distillery. Aye, nothing warms the cockles of your heart like a fine dram of whiskey. Whiskey, spelled with no eve, is Scottish, and it should be, comes from the old Gaelic word whiskivar, which means water of life. And indeed it is. Of course, delicious as that sweet ichor of the gods is, whiskey has one crucial problem. No, I'm not talking about street violence or the fact that certain neighbourhoods in Glasgow have a life expectancy rivaling Somalia. The major flaw with Scotch whiskey is, of course, that it's dead flat. How boring. It's like your liquor's playing possum with you. Now, there are four main types of Scotch whiskey: Speyside, Isla, Breakfast Scotch, and Premium Unleaded. And all of them are dead flat. Until now. Carbonated whiskey from Glenkevin has the peaty aroma and refined taste you want in a spirit, but it also has the bubbly personality of a high-quality bottle of Mr. Pibb and the ebullient charm of stolen champagne. Yes, whenever you sit down to a bottle of triple malt carbonated whiskey, you'll agree that all those bubbles are just like the Scotch itself is screaming in agony. Just screaming and screaming, howling into the vast, uncaring void in an anguished primal keen. Used to be in Scotland, we thought carbonated bubbles were the literal farts of demons, and we would burn whichever alchemist made them, and then charge the families for their firewood. We've come a long way since the days of Margaret Thatcher. Today we know that carbonated bubbles don't come from demon farts. They're what happens when molecules finally and conclusively just give up. Carbonated whiskey from Glenkevin Distillery. It's like the whiskey is screaming. Before I bring on my guest, I want to give a quick review of the Mueller report, which came out in redacted form last week. Not surprisingly, there was a lot of buzz about it on Friday. Here's my take. It is incredibly boring. What an awful read. The prose is flat and sterile, the characters are uninspiring, and the plot, insofar as it exists, is hardly a page-turner. I had assumed, with a name like The Mueller Report, it was going to be some kind of cool John Grisham-style novel, like The Pelican Brief. When you read the table of contents, you're like, oh, neat, Russians. Maybe this is going to be more Crimson Tide. Okay, awesome. But no, it's just a long, boring political war sock test. And spoiler alert, the president doesn't even go to prison, which would have at least made for a fun surprise ending. Here are things which aren't in the Mueller report. Ninjas, sex, a spunky sidekick, zombies, starships, old British sailing vessels, submarines, or a dog who can play basketball. Any of which would have made it a better read, but no. It's just a bloviating orange guy falling all over himself to try and keep Mueller from getting him. From a literary standpoint, it's dreck. So, because I have a flourish for writing, I've tried to spice up this abysmal document. Take this section from page 290. This is where Trump finds out that Mueller is the one conducting the investigation. It reads, the president learned of the special counsel's appointment from Sessions, who was with the president, Hunt, and McGahn, conducting interviews for a new FBI director. Sessions stepped out of the Oval Office to take a call from Rosenstein, who told him about the special counsel appointment, and Sessions then returned to inform the president of the news. According to the notes written by Hunt, when Sessions told the president that a special counsel had been appointed, the president slumped back in his chair and said, oh my God, this is terrible. This is the end of my presidency. I'm the president became angry and lambasted the attorney general for his decision to recuse from the investigation, saying, how could you let this happen, Jeff? Ugh. All right. So that's the original one. Now I'm going to read you my version. Sessions told the president that a special counsel had been appointed. The president slumped back in his chair and said, "Oh my God, this is terrible. This is the end of my presidency. I'm Mike Pence emerged from the shadows, grim-faced and resolved. "It's the end of the line, Biff," he said, pulling a revolver out of his shoulder holster. He handed it grip first to the president, who stared down at the loaded pistol in disbelief. "Do it," said Pence, guiding the nuzzle of the gun towards him. "Do it." See, that way's way more interesting. Here's another section of the original version. In February 2014, Ivanka Trump met with Emin Algalarov and toured the Crocus City site during a visit to Moscow. From March 2014 through July 2014, the group discussed design standards and other agricultural elements. For example, in July 2014, members of the Trump organization sent Crocus group counterparties questions about the demographics of these prospective buyers in the Crocus City area, the developments of neighboring parcels and Crocus City and concepts for redesigning portions of the building. Okay, we get it. Thanks. All right. Here's my version. Much better. Ivanka Trump had a weak spot for two things: architecture and Russians with thick necks. And that made Emin Algalarov the perfect storm. She strutted into his office in a tight, thigh-length trench coat, and he stood up to shake her hand and held it just a bit longer than he should have. "It's a pleasure to see you again, Ivanka," he said. Ivanka pursed her lips. "Good to be seen, Emin." She took a seat and then slowly uncrossed and crossed her legs. "You gonna pour a lady a drink?" Emin smiled and set a bottle of vodka over the architectural guidelines for the Crocus site's counterparty regulatory queries. If he didn't have that bottle of vodka to distract him, he mused, it would be all he could do to stop himself from knocking everything off the desk and grabbing this young American woman with his strong Slavic arms. That's when Mike Pence emerged from the shadows, grim-faced and resolved. "It's the end of the line, Biff," he said, pulling a revolver out of his shoulder holster. He slapped it down on the desk hard and slid it to Emin. "Do it," he said. "Do it." See, my version is far more entertaining. Okay, now here's the bit where Jeff Sessions, about Jeff Sessions from the original report. Also on May 18th, Sessions finalized a resignation letter that stated, "Pursuant to our conversation of yesterday and at your request, I hereby offer my resignation." Sessions, accompanied by Hunt, brought the letter to the White House and handed it to the president. The president put the resignation letter in his pocket and asked Sessions several times whether he wanted to continue serving as attorney general. Sessions ultimately told the president he wanted to stay, but it was up to the president. The president said he wanted Sessions to stay. At the conclusion of the meeting, the president shook Sessions' hand but did not return the resignation letter. Okay, here again. I can save this boring doorstop of a book by adding some juice. Here's what I would add. Sessions stepped out of the Oval Office and, after shutting the door, stared at a portrait of George Washington. "I heard you tried to resign, imp," said Mike Pence, emerging from the shadows, grim-faced and resolved. "Did he take your resignation letter?" "Spider," said Jeff Sessions. "You're ubiquitous. I assume you already knew he took my letter, but has not yet accepted my resignation." "Of course," said Pence. "I have little birdies everywhere. Did you give him the other letter, imp?" "No," said Sessions. "But I've hidden it, and if something bad should happen to me, my friends will release it. And then you're through, Spider." Pence nodded. No one could know the contents of Jeff Sessions' other letter, that the true king of Westeros was Michael Dukakis, because his real parents were Dwight Eisenhower and Rhaegar Targaryen. Mike Pence opened a window and tossed a revolver at some Canadian tourists. "End of the line, Biff," he shouted. "Do it! Do it!" So far, I am knocking this out of the park every time I sit down at my typewriter, whereas Mueller is dribbling out tedious, convoluted novel where the president and his campaign don't technically collude with the Russians but are still perfectly happy for them to interfere in the election, and then the president tries to obstruct justice anyway but doesn't manage to pull it off. Boring! If I had written it, here's what I would have done. I would have made Trump innocent of colluding with the Russians, but then I would have had him willfully obstruct Mueller's investigation anyway, and that obstruction of justice would then lead to his impeachment, which would be hilarious. Also, I would have added a dog who plays basketball. If free market economist Milton Friedman were still alive, and not just a force ghost like Obi-Wan Kenobi, I think he would favor a carbon tax. In fact, you can go back and watch him spar with Phil Donahue about how to handle pollution, and Friedman said this.
There is a case for the government protecting third parties, protecting people who have not voluntarily agreed to enter. So there's more of a case, for example, for emission control than there is for airbags. Mm-hmm. But the question is, what's the best way to do it? And the best way to do it is not to have bureaucrats in Washington write rules and regulations saying that a car has to carry this, that, or the other. The best way to do it is to impose a tax on the amount of pollutants emitted by a car and make it in the self-interest of the car manufacturers and of the consumers to keep down the amount of pollution in that way.
For a while, that represented the break between big government and small government approaches to environmentalism. Progressives liked the idea of the EPA telling factories how many smokestacks to have, how often to scrub them, having experts micromanage the economy to lessen pollutants. Conservatives assumed the private sector is more innovative than the government and so preferred giving the market an incentive like a carbon tax or a prize and then stepping back and letting companies figure things out on their own. And I'll note that environmentalism hasn't always been a strictly partisan issue. If you go back to Nixon, he formed the EPA. Barry Goldwater was a staunch conservationist. George H.W. Bush signed the Clean Air Act into law. And even as late as 2008, you have John McCain running for president and saying he thinks man-made climate change is real, which seems unfathomable in the current GOP. I'm in that camp. I think global warming is real. I think we're contributing to it. And I think there's a role for government. What I would like to see happen is for more conservatives and libertarians to sit down at the table to try and fix it. And the debate could really use those voices. Let me give you a couple of examples. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently proposed the Green New Deal, which we covered and mostly excoriated on this program. Right out of the gate, she's against nuclear power, as are a lot of progressive activists. Conservatives could and should step up and say, look, if you're serious about lessening carbon emissions, if you want to have a real adult conversation about this, then nuclear power is the quickest way to decarbonize the economy, and it needs to be on the table. I would like to see conservatives participate in this debate so that they can call out the dumb ideas that are already inside of it. Ditto fracking. I know a lot of progressives who view fracking as inherently evil, like we're strangling the earth for its bone marrow. But if you view environmentalism as a field of trade-offs rather than quasi-religious totemic thinking, fracking is the best thing that happened to American environmentalism in the last 20 years. Natural gas burns cleaner than coal, and the natural gas revolution dropped our carbon footprint precipitously. We didn't sign the Kyoto Protocols, but we wound up surpassing them anyway, and that was because of fracking. So I'd like to see more people with market-oriented individual rights values join the table and work on this issue. One such person is my guest today, Jerry Taylor, who is the president of the Niskanen Center. Jerry Taylor, thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Andrew. It's good to be here.
Thank you. And I met you, I think, back when you were at Cato, and you were a Cato guy for a while, weren't you? A very free market think tank and have been part of that environment for some time?
Yeah, I was brought on in 1991 to be the director of energy policy studies at Cato, and I soon took over the environmental portfolio as well. And I spent 23 years there, moving up the ranks, but primarily engaged in climate and environmental debate. I ended up as a vice president, one of several, and left to start the Niskanen Center in 2014, largely because there just wasn't room at the Cato Institute for someone to take a mainstream position on climate science.
Yeah. So what happened there? Because I like Cato. I'm a big fan of the kind of the premier libertarian think tank. And as I understand it, you had been a fairly skeptical individual on climate change for a while. What was the turnover for you?
Yeah, I spent most of my career at Cato, going into the pages of the Wall Street Journal, going on Fox News, going into the pages of National Review, speaking on college campuses, going on Stossel's show, John Stossel's show on Fox, yeah. and making the case for climate skepticism, that global warming was real, but it was not going to be the end times that environmentalists had argued, and probably a very modest effect. And the costs of doing something about it were just extremely steep and would be more costly than to let things play out. But over the course of 23 years of engaging in this debate, I found that the arguments I was forwarding were increasingly falling apart.
Okay.
Unlike a lot of people in the climate debate, my job was, or at least as I saw it, was actually to persuade people, as opposed to just be the best table pounder for our team. Mm-hmm. I actually wanted to wage and win a war of ideas with the best people on the other side, which means you have to pay attention to their evidence. You have to confront them directly. You can't just call them names or distort their their ideas. And if you're in the business of, you know, knowing their evidence better than they know it, which is how you win debates, typically, you find that their stuff was increasingly strong as the years went on.
Okay. And so you just got to a point where you went, maybe I should be more panic-stricken than I am? Or was there a push point, or was it just sort of the accumulation of evidence that put you in the other camp?
Well, there are a few things. The very first thing that gave me doubts was when I was on a TV debate with a guy named Joe Rahm. He's a physicist, presently now at the Center for American Progress, but he used to be in some various Democratic administrations, and he was he's still a very prominent climate realist. And in the debate, I forget what network we were on, but we were having a conversation. You know, it's been more than a decade since James Hansen testified in front of the United States Senate in 1988, saying that if we continued on a business-as-usual path, climate change would be a very dramatic event, and he actually had temperature projections. And I said, Joe, we have had business-as-usual since then, and we've only seen about a quarter of the warming that James Hansen predicted, which tells you that his models run hot. It doesn't mean global warming is not happening, but it means that the models aren't reflecting, you know, atmospheric reality, which suggests that warming is not going to be so dramatic. So this was in the early 2000s. We go back into the green room where they take off the makeup and the microphones and all that.
Yeah.
And Joe Rahm said, did you even read, you know, Hansen's testimony that you just got done mangling here on the air? And I said, it's been a while, but yeah. I said, but the narrative I offered was given recently by a colleague of mine at the Cato Institute in front of Senate testimony, so I'm pretty familiar with this story. And he says, well, let me tell you what's really going on here. Or you terribly misunderstood it. James Hansen did indeed provide a business as usual scenario, as you say. And he also did provide the temperature projections that you noted, and that, yes, they were, you know, they suggested more warming would have occurred than we've seen. So, but the main reason is that he overestimated the amount of emissions we'd have. So he gave that testimony before the Montreal Protocol, which banned a lot of greenhouse gases to protect for ozone depletion. Mm-hmm. And he said, we've also had a major recession in the course of that time. We've had a move towards natural gas in the power sector. So it turns out we haven't been putting up near as many greenhouse gases as he thought we might by this time down the road. So yeah, his numbers were off, but it's because he over-projected emissions. He says, you want to say he's a bad economist or something, fine, but not that the models run hot. He says, and the point is he also gave a couple of other scenarios in that testimony reflecting various assumptions with regards to emissions, many of them much lower emissions profiles. And he said, Jerry, he ran temperature projections well. B, he said, which you didn't discuss, had emissions projections that pretty much track what we've seen since 1988. And if you look at the temperature projections that he offered for scenario B, they're pretty much spot on. He said, so when you go on the air and you say that, you know, the models run hot and the atmosphere is not as sensitive to greenhouse gases as we thought, he says, that's basically a load of crap. And he said, but notice it took me about 5 minutes to explain this to you. I don't have 5 minutes on CNN to do that on the air. He said, look, if you want to be a hack for the rest of your life, just keep playing these games. He said, because I hate going on the air with people like you, and I'm not going to do it again. He said, but if you don't want to be a hack, go back to your office, reread Hansen's testimony. You tell me I'm wrong. Well, that's a heck of a challenge. I went back to my office, and I reread the testimony, and it turns out, yeah, it seemed like Joe was right. And so I went to my colleague at Cato at the time, who was a, you know, credentialed scientist and published in the peer-reviewed literature. He was the one who was making these arguments. And I said, on the area I just told you, and I said, what am I missing? Because it looks like Joe's right. And it turns out I wasn't missing anything, that this scientist fully understood that the story he was offering in front of the United States Senate and in various op-eds and, you know, TV interviews was really disingenuous. It was misrepresenting James Hansen, and it was misrepresenting these climate projections. But he didn't care because it was a heck of a good story, right? I mean, you can go on the air and honestly say that Hansen's, you know, projected if we continued on a business-as-usual path, we'd see four times more warming. Run hot. Well, notice all the way to the present now, this is a storyline that you hear out of a lot of climate denial. You know, Hansen's a fraud, his stuff's been debunked, you know, his models are crazy, they don't reflect reality, and that's just not true. So the point was, when I found out that this scientist was purposefully being disingenuous and misrepresenting the debate, it gave me a lot of pause because, you know, like a lot of your listeners, we can't be an experts in everything. I'm not a scientist. I'm a pretty good debater. I'm a pretty smart guy, but I'm not a scientist. So I have to rely on my allies in the scientific community to positively inform what I'm saying. And I found out that I couldn't trust them. And so once I started doing the due diligence I should have been doing all along, I found that that story that I just told you played out over and over and over and over again. Sometimes it was conscious misrepresentation. Sometimes it was cherry picking data. Sometimes it was just crappy work. Sometimes it, you know, it was misrepresenting the underlying debate. And I found this constantly, you know, virtually anything coming out of the scientific community anymore from, you know, my allies. That wasn't the only thing that moved me away from my old position of climate skepticism, but it was a really important one because it demonstrated to me that there was a lot of dodginess going on in this debate.
So you brought up two things. One, that you're not a scientist. I, too, am not a scientist. And you brought up the concept of due diligence. One of the things that I find difficult about getting into policies on global warming and climate change is, not being a scientist, there is so much data to sift through that a lot of the time what I wind up doing is I just have various thinkers that I have a lot of respect for that I follow. So like Ron Bailey over at Reason is kind of my top guy. What is a course of due diligence people can do where they can be reasonably informed on something without having to read, you know, 20 books?
Well, there are a couple of websites that are very helpful here. All during the time, well, during most of my time at Cato, I wasn't quite aware of them because they didn't come from, you know, our world or our community and the other side. But if you are on Twitter or Facebook or having a conversation and somebody tells you, you know, we've had this hiatus in warming and it's kind of leveled out and we don't see temperature increases like we expected to see over the last decade, There's a website called skepticalscience.org or .com, I forget, just type skeptical science in there. And they have a wonderful compendium of climate denialist arguments or climate skeptic arguments with beginner, intermediate, and advanced levels of rebuttal, depending upon how, you know, crunchy you want to get into the science. And it's a tremendous resource. Now, it could some of the essays are a little bit dated. We've got on our own website at the Niskanen Center, a website called Climate Unplugged, where we try to do the same sort of thing. But the reality is you can, it's not that hard to go hunt down a claim to see if it holds up or not.
Okay.
And you can find the underlying reality. So for instance, when it came to the famous hiatus in warming from a few years ago, is why that should not surprise you. I mean, warming moves in fits and starts. It doesn't move on an even line. It turns out that the oceans were sucking up a lot of the greenhouse gases that we thought might otherwise have been going to the atmosphere. So the oceans were warming. So that was playing out. But it's not going to go on forever in that fashion. And warming then took off again a couple of years ago, and there's not much of a hiatus conversation anymore. So, you know, it's just not that difficult. If one of your listeners wants to, you know, dig into this stuff, it's all there. It just requires the will to go find it.
Yeah, I think one of the things I find difficult about this entire debate is that so much of it, I think, is rooted in tribalism, which is something that I frequently visit on the program. But I think for a lot of people, there's a kind of religious element to this, whether you think it's happening or not. And the default position is to err on the side of whatever, red team or blue team. And so I don't see, I think that there's a cognitive element at work here where people are apt to go one direction or the other very hard. Without necessarily doing the data for themselves. One thing that I am worried about is me being someone who's coming from this classical liberal disposition, markets are good, regulation is generally bad. I have been saying for a while, look, global warming's not a hoax, it's happening, we need to sit down and work on this, this is not a conspiracy to take over the economy. But then someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will come along and go, hey, this is a great opportunity to remake the entire economy and put it under the control of bureaucrats, and also will help the environment. And when that kind of thing happens, it's difficult for me to posit that argument because it does seem there's a kind of political opportunism happening as well in sync with this.
Sure. For a lot of people in the environmental world, climate change is the tip of the spear for why capitalism needs to be dismantled or put aside. And you don't need to go to our Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for that. You could go to Naomi Klein for that. There's a book that she wrote a few years ago called This, in which she makes the case for why and the reality of what's now presently happening is the final nail in the coffin of global capitalism and one of the reasons we need to move it aside. So look, that's always been there, just as in our world of, or my old world of classical liberalism and libertarianism, you can likewise find nutty people. If you want to go cite narratives about motivation that, you know, would make people on the left have their hair stand up too. Okay. The reality, though, is that most people who are climate activists or climate hawks are not communists. They're not socialists. They don't hate industrial society. They're simply freaked out over the fact that from now is going to look radically different than the world we have today, and one that is not going to be very positive for our children and our grandchildren. And they want to act to do something about that. It doesn't make them communists. And just because Naomi Klein's out there or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is out there doesn't mean that everyone is of like mind, just as not everyone who supports Donald Trump always thinks the same sort of thing.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, on that note, then, how freaked out are you? What is your panic scale?
That's pretty high. I mean, we're already seeing the impacts of climate change play out in real time right now. Right now. And is not only do we see more superstorms, more extreme weather events, we can see a play out in areas that don't necessarily draw your attention, but their underlying causes of significant problems. So, for instance, the Syrian migration crisis is not entirely driven by climate change, but it was a really important contributor because there was a terrible drought for about a decade in Syria, which caused a lot of rural people. It was sort of throwing a match into dry kindling. A lot of other things indeed happened, but were it not for that drought, which a lot of scientists now argue was a function that climate change contributed towards, we might not have seen the sort of hellscape that we've seen now follow out of Syria. The same thing is going on in Guatemala in Central America, and similarly, these climatic events which are messing around with long-standing patterns of rainfall and growth and whatnot are likewise now increasingly thought to be driving a lot of the migration there. It's not the only reason. M13, you know, has a lot to do with it as well. But it is an important contributor, and we're seeing that play out in the wildfires in California, which are much more likely because of climate change. We're going to see a lot more of that. It's bad enough as it is, but if you look at the kind of risks we're taking, when temperatures move from about 1 degree Celsius above back to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, 3 degrees above pre-industrial levels, that's Celsius, by the way. We're seeing, you know, we're playing a lot of, we're taking a lot of risks. Not only are we going to see all of what I've just described by two or by three or by four, we're also going to be running the risk of passing tipping points that can have radical impacts on the climate. But we've never done this experiment before. We have never loaded up the atmosphere with this much greenhouse gases since man's walked the earth. So we don't know exactly where these tipping points are and what the consequences might be. But we know that they're potentially there. So why would we, you know, why would you roll dice for the future of the planet just because, what, you don't want to spend 20 cents a gallon more for gasoline and pay what you maybe paid 3 years ago? Life went on at the time. Why is it the people who identify as conservatives are being so unconservative about the only planet we have?
Can you, because I want to get into you or into the policies that you've got here in a second, but before we do that, you mentioned a couple of tipping points. I'm aware of a couple of them. One of them is that there's, I guess, permafrost on the Arctic, and that if that thaws out, it releases a bunch of methane, and so it sort of kicks everything into high gear. There's also the possibility that we could jack with the Atlantic, the Gulf Current in the Atlantic, and that could alter the weather patterns in Europe and that kind of thing. What are the tipping points, and what's the, is there any way to assess their feasibility or the probability of them being reached?
It's very difficult to put percentages on the possibility that some of these extreme scenarios could play out. Again, because we don't have any data points to repair to. This is a one-off experiment. And so we can only speculate. Those are some of the things which can occur. There's an accelerated ice melt that could occur in the Antarctic and the Arctic, which could have major impacts on sea level rise, far greater sea level rise than we are anticipating right now, which is already bad enough. But you could see a turbocharged move in that direction, which could have huge consequences. And it's very difficult to say. We know that the possibilities are out there. We know that there are a lot of uncertainties. So if you were to, you know, just consider the possibility that an extreme scenario could play out, but it could play out on this point, this point, this point, this point, this point, it really ought to grab your attention. You know, when he was vice president, Dick Cheney, right after 9/11, said something to this effect. If you recall, there was a conversation about Pakistan's nuclear weaponry, mm-hmm. and whether the Pakistani military might be tempted, some of the more radical extremists in the military, might be tempted to hand off nuclear weaponry to Al-Qaeda. And there was a great debate about what we should do about that. And Dick Cheney said on national television, I believe it was on Meet the Press, he said, look, if there's even just a 1% chance that that could happen, that the Pakistani military might hand off, or their intelligence services might hand off nuclear weaponry to Al-Qaeda, we have to treat it as a certainty as far as policy response. Whether you would agree with that statement. If you believe that, and Dick Cheney clearly did, then how does that story change any when we're talking about climate change? I mean, it seems to me that that sort of risk tolerance for, or limited risk tolerance for playing games with the future of the United States, certainly ought to apply when we're playing games for the future of the planet. And some of the more extreme scenarios really do have a Book of Revelations quality to it that are, you know, for all I know, it's a 1% or 2% chance, but why would we play those games? Especially since there are things we can do right now to head this off, bring us into a nation of Amish people. We could have an industrial society and economic growth and all that with that, while having wealth creation, while addressing climate change.
So before we get into how to address it, one more kind of devil's advocate question I want to kick at you. Something that makes me uncomfortable when I go through climate change policy recommendations, and this might be the Hansen piece that you're referring to, but the other day somebody sent me an article from AP, you know, fairly neutral news source, and it was from, I think, 1988, and it was a UN official saying, we've got to retool the whole global economy in 10 years, or we're all going to die. And I looked at that and went, well, we didn't. I mean, is that the same kind of thing where there was a dip, or there was a hiatus or something? Or I guess the more alarmism I see in retrospect, the more concerned I am that it is just that.
Well, yeah, I mean, this would not be very different if you heard Sergio Cortez say, you know, a lot of these economists say that the Green New Deal is unaffordable. But look back in 1988, this one economist said something that was pretty off the mark about economic growth, so we should not listen to any economists in the future. Hmm. I mean, what is that? We would never accept that argument in a different context, but we casually throw it out here and say, well, can I find somebody on the other side of this debate who made an extreme argument that borderlines on hair on fire panic that proved incorrect. Can I do that? Sure, I can. I can find people on either side of any debate you could imagine who in the past were wrong, and then cite them and then argue what? That means we should never entertain those conversations again? Because I'll tell you what, if we were going to play that game, just to give you an idea of how dodgy that game is, I can find you virtually every single conservative economist when Bill Clinton raised taxes during the first term of his presidency, they argued that was going to destroy our ability to come out of the recession, bring us into another one. It never happened. So what, we should like shoot all the conservative economists that ever listened to him again? Of course not. But these are the kind of lazy arguments that I constantly hear from climate skeptics. And we would never entertain these lazy arguments in other contexts. But as you said earlier, people have motivated cognition. They want to believe certain things. So they'll grab on to whatever sounds good and, you know, put it out there.
Well, so then accepting that global warming is a problem, we should be doing something about it. Can you kind of map me out the lay of the land of where the various schools of policies are and where you are within that?
Well, most economists and policy experts who study climate change and various mitigation strategies agree that the best thing to do is to put a price on greenhouse gas emissions. Mm. You can do that either with cap and trade, which is essentially a taxing program, or you can just do it directly with a carbon tax. There was recently, so if you look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, which every few years comes out with a summary of the literature on climate change, you'll find that in their discussion about how best to address it, that there is almost as much a consensus that carbon pricing in general and carbon taxation in particular is a necessary prerequisite to addressing climate change. So there's very little debate about that. In fact, there was recently a statement by economists that was released by the Climate Leadership Council, which found that, and it was the largest such statement of economists that has ever been put together, 27 Nobel laureate economists, 15 former chairs of the Council of Economic Advisors, 2 former secretaries, U.S. Department of Treasury, 4 former chairmen of the Federal Reserve Board, in fact, all the living former chairmen of the Fed, and 3,508 U.S. economists agree that the right approach is to tax greenhouse gas emissions at their source.
So that Jerry, you cut out there for a second. I apologize. You cut out for a second. You said tax greenhouse gas emissions at their source, I think. I couldn't
get that. At their source, yeah. Okay. So we'll tax oil where it's produced, coal where it's produced, natural gas where it's produced, based on its carbon content. And then we take those revenues and we rebate them in lump sums to the American public so that we're made whole. But we get the price signals correct. And this wouldn't be the only policy response to climate change, but it would be the central and most important one.
Okay. So when you say tax to the source, because I want to make sure that I understand the nuts and bolts of the carbon taxes you're proposing it, this would not be a situation in which I am taxed for driving my car, but I am going to pay a tax on the gasoline that comes in? Or is it that I guess I'm not paying a tax on the gasoline, rather the person that's getting the oil is paying a tax, and then that's presumably given to me as a consumer?
Yeah, I mean, it's really not different from severance taxes. Now, you or your viewers may not be...
I am not.
...may not be familiar with severance tax. And in Wyoming, in most places where we produce fossil fuels in this country, state governments tax their extraction. They impose a tax for various different reasons. Well, that's basically a carbon. Nobody calls it a carbon tax, but it is a carbon tax. So we tax the production of these fossil fuels. And so it's a corporate tax, that does affect, or it can affect, what consumers pay at the pump or pay when they get their electricity bill. But it's not something that a consumer is going to have to, take care of like a sales tax.
Right.
So when we're talking about what we're talking about, taxing at the point of extraction or as close to it, some industries are a little bit different from that regard, with existing tax collection points. We're taxing fossil fuel companies. And then if they try to move the price and the burden onto consumers, the fact that we could rebate a lot of those revenues back to consumers, make sure that people are relatively made whole.
And so where does the lessening carbon factor into this? Is the idea that you're going to put a carbon tax on companies and they will endeavor to figure out how to limit the carbon they're putting out? And so they're going to be developing more efficient technology, how does the incentive work on them?
You're basically crowdsourcing the idea of reducing greenhouse gas emissions nationally once you do that, because once you tax the fuels for their carbon content, you are providing an incentive for every end user to look for cheaper alternatives. So maybe that sector might be nuclear power relative to natural gas.
Gotcha.
Or maybe
okay.
It will be renewable energy. Or maybe consumers, when they see the price of energy go up generally, because renewable energy is still a small part of our energy portfolio, they may decide it makes sense to invest in energy efficiency and cars that get better mileage or insulation for their homes, or more fuel efficient or energy efficient air conditioners or heating or cooling systems or refrigerators. Once, as Milton Friedman said at the beginning of your show, once we get price signals to accurately reflect true costs, then we don't need to tell consumers and manufacturers and industrialists exactly what to do. We're unleashing the creative minds of the economy who are interested in saving money and making profit to respond accordingly. And we don't have to have this grand debate about whether nuclear power is better than wind power, which is better than solar power, which is better than carbon capture and storage, which might be figure that out. And that's one of the reasons why carbon taxation is so attractive to people on the right of the on the right side of the political spectrum. It is a non-bureaucratic, non-governmental response, in a sense, to climate change. It's infinitely better than having all the questions I just mentioned sorted out by EPA or Department of Energy or the United States Congress, because I have very little faith that we are going to have those conversations play out very well when you're getting politics in the middle of all this. Rather, better to leave it to the market where we can.
Yeah, I would definitely, in almost every consideration, I'd probably rather have the market sort out than bureaucrats. I like where your head's at. I do have a couple of concerns with a carbon tax. One of them is, if you make it too high, don't you risk driving business out of the United States, potentially to countries that have lesser environmental regulations? Because if that were the case, then we would lose out that revenue and we would have more carbon anyway.
It's not really that big a problem if the percentage of the of energy costs in their manufacturing process is actually fairly low. So a carbon tax would not likely induce more than about 5% of the manufacturers and various other corporate actors to even consider moving across national borders. That having been said, virtually every carbon tax that has been proposed would allow companies to get a rebate when they export products to places which don't have carbon taxation. So they're competitive in those export markets. And likewise, taxes imports as if they were made in the United States and paying the carbon taxes that domestic manufacturers and producers are paying. And that levels the playing field. So under scenarios like that, then there's no particular reason why a manufacturer would move facilities from the United States to some place where there is no carbon pricing, because you know they're not being harmed in export.
out of curiosity, when I look at when I look at climate change, when I look at global solutions and that sort of thing. I've read Matt Ridley's book, and he makes a really good point in, I think it's The Rational Optimist, that the IPCC panels that you mentioned earlier are predicated on, or the model that they have of global warming really reaching, you know, high levels, it's predicated on the idea that the second and third world are going to keep advancing. And so I look at that and I think, well, we can't tighten the belt enough for the United States to compensate for other countries like China. So it would seem to me that innovation needs to be the top priority in any type of environmental strategy we have, because if we're draconian, we're not going to be able to, there's just not enough carbon we can squeeze out to make a difference. There has to be some sort of game changer coming out. Do you think that a carbon tax would be better at that than, say, like a prize, like the X Prize or something? I know that Newt Gingrich used to be in favor of sort of a prize incentive strategy.
Well, Andrew, there's a lot there, so let me try to walk through each of these issues, but there's good question. It's not as if we need to find magic technologies to do this. We already see now in low carbon technologies like wind and solar power that they can't compete right now with fossil fuels. If you look at the levelized cost of production, which is a data point that people in the utility sector and various other industries examine when new facilities are being considered, we find right now. That clean, low-carbon, renewable energy is economically competitive with fossil fuels. So we don't need to, you know, sit down and wish for magic to figure out how we're going to decarbonize this economy. We have those technologies now. That having been said, the cheaper they are, the lower the cost of transition, of course, because they're not cheaper than all fossil fuels in all contexts in every different use. That's certainly true. But what a carbon price would do is incentivize that innovation. I mean, after all, people aren't going to innovate just because you ask them pretty please to do some fun and cool stuff. They're going to do it when they have, you know, profit incentives to do it. If you increase the price of fossil fuels based on their carbon content, then you create all the incentives required for innovative investigations, technologies to emerge as a means of response to the price. You know, and one of the things that always struck me is my old colleagues at the Cato Institute and in the libertarian world, they love to talk about Julian Simon. Boy, you get into a conversation about environmental policy, Julian Simon will come up in about 5 minutes, mm-hmm. and he's a trump card, because Julian Simon argued that innovation in technologies occur, right? His main argument against the Malthusians and Paul Ehrlich back in the 70s and 1980s is that whenever we see a scarcity in the market, when nickel becomes scarce, copper becomes scarce, wheat becomes scarce, whatever it might be, whatever commodity becomes scarce, prices go up, people in the market have an incentive to innovate, to respond to that increased price, new technologies arise, mm-hmm. and almost in all cases, these new technologies and new processes that were produced as a response to the scarcity leave us better off than if the scarcity had never happened. And he argued that, you know, necessity is the motherhood of invention, and it plays out on a global scale when it comes to natural resources. So libertarians love to tell the story about why we shouldn't worry about scarcity in the way that a lot of people on the left were worried about in the 1970s yeah. and 1980s. Well, that same story applies to climate change. If the costs of if scarcities occur in fossil fuels as a consequence of, say, government policy, bleak the carbon content of fossil fuels, it's as if they were becoming more scarce. Then as a response to that scarcity, market actors will respond. And if past is prologue, the responses will produce a whirlwind, then even if the scarcity had never happened. You know, so it's odd to me that libertarians and conservatives can so, you know, embrace Julian Simon in all these other contexts, but then assume that when it comes to energy markets and climate change, all of a sudden every last insight Julian Simon had is no longer operable. It seems to me it's very operable.
Unpack the prizes for me, because there's a good C-SPAN debate from years ago between John Kerry and Newt Gingrich, where I think at the time Newt Gingrich was believed global warming was happening and we were causing it. And the breakdown was John Kerry being on the give the EPA a lot of power to micromanage, and Newt Gingrich wanted to have kind of Charles Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic, XPRIZE type things. And he thought incentivizing the private sector to develop through prizes would be a good way of doing it. Why a carbon tax as opposed to prizes?
Well, first of all, we're not entirely sure what we're supposed to offer as far as a prize. So, for instance, are we going to say we're going to give you a prize if you produce low-cost fourth-generation nuclear power? Well, that's kind of tilting the playing field, because we don't want to necessarily say, okay, give me, you know, low-cost nuclear power as opposed to give me low-cost offshore wind. The point, there are so many different technologies, so many different manufacturing decisions which will be affected by price that can't be reflected by a world of 10,000 technology prizes. So there's just a practical sense of this. And secondly, it's not as if we don't know how to use government R&D to promote innovation in this country. We do, and we've seen it with price. So for instance, the entire fracking revolution was a consequence of two things. It was a consequence of George Mitchell, the engineer who produced this new fracking technology that is so proliferate now in the energy markets, is the first to tell you, and has told Congress in testimony, that if it were not for those U.S. Department of Energy R&D projects and funds that he was engaged in, the fracking revolution would never have occurred. So it's not as, and that wasn't from prizes. This is just from good old-fashioned R&D subsidies from the federal government. And the second thing was price. I mean, people forget natural gas came, the fracking revolution came on the scene as a consequence of rising natural gas prices. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, figuring out new and cheaper ways to get at gas was a critically important consideration. You know, it's not as if price signals won't do the job. It's a constant mystery to me why people on the right think that capitalism is so great and markets are so efficient and price signals are so magical. They're just terrible things and we can never rely on them or trust them or anything of the kind. We don't need to have the kind of Newt Gingrich policies to provide the sorts of innovations we're interested in. Now, that having been said, I'm not against, you know, prizes. My friend Jonathan Adler, who's on my side on climate change, used to be the director of environmental policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute some years back, now at Case Western University. Makes a pretty good argument for why prizes might be part of your R&D portfolio at the federal level in the course of decarbonization. I've got no problem with it, but it can't be the it can't be the main, because getting price signals correct is the most important thing we can do to decarbonize the economy and to make the economy more efficient, actually, because right now we have inaccurate price signals. The price of various goods and services do not reflect the total cost. And when they don't, then a lot of economic inefficiency follows. And that's been something conservatives have preached from Econ 101 from time immemorial. So on that basis, if nothing else, tells you that getting those price signals correct is very important.
What are, you said there's some inaccuracies built in. What are those?
Well, they're not accounting for the damages done by greenhouse gas emissions.
Right.
So, I mean, usually when you buy something in the market and it costs X, that cost reflects in part the cost of production, right? And what it takes to get that product to you, and all the costs associated with getting it to the consumer. Well, in energy markets and in a lot of manufacturing markets, and I've not including things like the costs associated with climate change that are associated with using that gallon of gasoline or that ton of coal or what have you. Nor, by the way, does it fully account for just the conventional air pollution damages that are done by fossil fuels. So if you had accurate price signals, you would have a more efficient economy overall, because it might be that we would be causing less harm to third parties and to ourselves if the price signals were correct.
Okay. Jerry, I think that's all the time we have for today. I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you for describing this, and come on again.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been a pleasure, and look forward to being on again.
Little bit of listener feedback before we conclude today's program. Mino1 on iTunes says, it's refreshing to have a civil political discussion where both sides are actually discussing an issue instead of talking past each other. Well done. Keep it up and keep eating at Snuffy's. It is a terrific diner. Thank you for the plug. You can watch this whole show on YouTube if you look for Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. You can see my handsome bearded face and assortment of suits and dead bison head we screwed onto the wall. Watching Something's Off with Andrew Heaton on your computer will make you seem more sophisticated and amusing at your office. Watching it in the shower will enhance your ablutionary experience. I think ablutionary means cleaning. Just make sure you put your laptop in a clear plastic bag before don't do that. Jenny, you're going to kill all these poor people. Don't take your laptop into the shower. It's a funny mental image. Anyway, you know what? He even says this. I'm sorry. Let me back up. Put your laptop in a clear plastic bag before taking it with you into the water. Oh, man, guys, you see that we're getting kind of worried now. Also, don't plug it in. Good advice. Or if you do plug it in, make sure to wrap the entire cord in plastic. And maybe, you know what? Maybe just don't watch it in the shower, but everywhere else is fine. Jennings beat me to it. Well done, Jennings. So go to YouTube and start watching full episodes. I look like a tie wearing a human suit on its back. Yeah, all right, cool. Remember, you could always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/Mighty Heaton or subscribe to my newsletter and then just reply when you get the confirmation email or if and when I eventually send out more newsletters. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. That helps other people discover this here political orphanage. Thank you and good day.